This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. A benefit corporation, or B Corp, is a corporation that holds to a triple bottom line. It's one that values workers and the environment along with financial profit. The organization that certifies B Corps, B Lab, recently released a list of 20 best corporations for the earth. Four Piedmont-based companies appear on that list: Southern Energy Management, Larry's Beans, Piedmont Biofuels, and the Redwoods Group. Kevin Trapani founded the Redwoods Group in 1997. After years of working in insurance, Kevin wanted to create a company that worked as a partner for community businesses. Personally, the success of the Redwoods Group has allowed Kevin to participate in community in many, many ways, including serving on the community advisory board of this radio station, WUNC. Kevin Trapani is my guest on the program today. Welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. I'm honored to be here.
Let's start with the B Corp. Give us an amplified version of what that is, a B Corp.
So a for-benefit corporation, or a B-certified corporation, is a company that recognizes the interests of multiple stakeholders instead of just shareholders in every decision that the organization makes. It recognizes those interests in its very governing documents, and it agrees to be measured by an outside agency, in this case B Lab, each year on whether or not it walks the talk, a pretty rigorous set of standards. So that's what makes a B corporation different.
And why did you want to be one?
Well, we felt a couple things. First, that B Lab standards were rigorous and would help us to get better. But we also had already determined that the community was an important stakeholder in the Redwoods Group. We had been running our company that way for quite some time, but had an inconsistent set of standards in terms of how we judged ourselves. B Lab gave us an infrastructure that was more consistent, more rigorous, more demanding, and helped us to understand the ways that we could get better.
The idea of B Lab came around after you founded your company in 1997. What was behind that? What was behind the theory of management? Because you'd already been thinking this way when you started Redwoods.
Well, we were sort of wackos when we started Redwoods. We went all over the company begging for money to start the company, and most people threw us. You know, we've been thrown out of the nicest places in the country. But we came along at a time when even the word social enterprise or social entrepreneurship was brand new. Greg Dees, who's now a professor at the Fuqua School at Duke, had coined the term in 1994-95. And we began thinking, as you mentioned in the intro, that there was a different way to run a company. There could be different beneficiaries than had traditionally been described. And so we kind of started down that path and we're looking for best practices. There was a beginning literature base on good activities. Companies like Patagonia and Ben & Jerry's were behaving in a different way. But there wasn't exactly a movement around it. There was a group of three guys who founded a sportswear company called And One that you may remember in the late 90s. And they ran that company up to about $300 million in sales. It was ultimately sold to a larger garment manufacturer. They had built the company to be what is would now be called a B Corp. When it was sold, that disintegrated. And the owners of the business said, hey, listen, it shouldn't be that way. There should be something that would survive a sale, something that would create a movement. And that's where they came up with B Lab, meaning for benefit lab.
So what was the impetus for you? Was it wanting to do more good, or was it a thought that, look, you know, the way things are going with a lot more interest in sustainability, better educated consumers, we might do better business if we just were more smart about our social responsibility?
Well, it's a great way to ask it, Frank, and there are really kind of three pieces to that answer. First of all, I grew up in a family. My dad ran veterans hospitals. And so I grew up in a family where being of the community and not above the community was just essential. I was reminded just about every day of those to whom much is given, much also is expected. Apparently, I needed some reminding. And so that's kind of the way I grew up. I always had been involved in community. I had the opportunity to grow up in the insurance business. I graduated here from Duke and went right to work for a great company called the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies and learned how much data insurers had about how people got injured and saw that as a lever for changing behavior among customers to make it less likely that people would get hurt. So that made good sense to me. I got fired three times in about 5.5 years because, quite frankly, I wasn't good enough to change big insurance companies, and I wanted to. And so then I had the opportunity. I thought it was unlikely that I would fire myself, though there are days. And so I had the opportunity to start a business, and we thought from the very beginning, look, let's run this business differently. I would say that we became cool. We didn't start the business because we thought there'd be this interest in sustainability and corporate social responsibility. I think we started the business to say we're going to behave differently because it's the right thing to do. Now, at the end of the day, all of our customers are nonprofit social service organizations, and so it was stupid on my part not to understand that the way we do business would resonate with them, and indeed it has.
And talk about your customers. Who are they?
We're the largest insurer of YMCAs, Jewish organizations, meaning Jewish community centers, Jewish family service organizations, and nonprofit resident camps in the country. A micro niche.
And so, and you talked about this just a second ago, the idea that part of the success of the business, if you're in insurance, is in working with your customers to reduce risk.
That's right. We started really with YMCAs. I'm a Y kid. I grew up in the Y. My dad moved quite a bit, and so I'd arrive at the next place, we'd find a church and a Y, and I had a home. So I am beholden to the YMCA movement in many, many ways, and so I know it well and love the Y. But there are things that can happen at a Y that make YMCAs and the other organizations we insure, JCCs, et cetera, unattractive to traditional insurers. Kids drown. Kids can get sexually abused. I think you know that in this country, if you're a woman and turn 18, the chances are better than 1 in 4 that you have been sexually abused. Those are – our society pays a horrific price for those kinds of things. As an insurer, we understand the circumstances under which those things are more or less likely to happen. So our model is a relatively elegant one. We spend a lot of time looking at the loss-causing data. We take that data, we turn it into actionable knowledge for our customers to help them change the way they operate. They then have fewer injuries or deaths, which helps them to move their programming to scale and allows us to come back and look at the data and drill down deeper and provide even more insightful guidance. It's what we call a virtuous cycle.
So what are the standards now that the B Corp is looking at that allow you to be rated and then ultimately honored and awarded?
Well, first of all, they want to see if we do what we said we were going to do in terms of how we run our business. So the model I just described to you actually is pretty good for community, right? Fewer kids would be touched inappropriately, et cetera. So they look at the efficacy of the business model itself and the are we doing important work, in other words. That's the first. The second is they want to know if we're doing it well. So they want to look at the sustainability of our financial model. You know, this would be fine if we do this really well, but if we don't make money, we don't get to do it very well for very long. So they look at the financial sustainability and then the work environment. So again, are we doing it well? Are we providing adequately for the benefits for our people? Are we maintaining a low turnover environment and those kinds of things? And then third, how are we behaving with regard to the rest of our stakeholders? Are we good for and engaged in the community? And those things are all measured.
Well, and let's stick with the benefits for your employers. I mean, what would you have to do to be a B Corporation? What kinds of benefits do you have to offer?
Well, there's a continuum. And so the beginning of that continuum is, do you provide health insurance for your employees? Because as you well know, there are a number of corporations that don't or don't for a significant portion of their employees. So that's kind of the starter. We go well beyond that, providing benefits not only for employees but for their families, not just health insurance benefits but all kinds of benefits, quite frankly, in our case, including college scholarships for the kids of our employees. So we remove the barrier, the financial barrier to a college education because we think that's an important part of serving our employees. One of the things that drives us is Maslow, which you didn't think was going to come up in this conversation. But
you never know.
Right. Maslow, you inspired me. Maslow taught us that if your most basic needs aren't being taken care of, you can't think communally. And as a dad, I've got 3 kids. I want to be able to send them to college. That's a pretty basic need. That's how it works.
So if you're taking care of the triple bottom line, the people, the planet, and the profit, you're an insurance company. You've got 90 employees. It's not a particularly dirty industry. I mean, is it fundamentally easier for some companies to qualify than others that might be in sort of processing, manufacturing, harder to keep it clean?
We have to pay attention in different areas. There are different rating approaches for a light manufacturing firm, for instance, or even heavy manufacturing. You mentioned Larry's Beans as one of the local organizations, or Piedmont Biofuel. So there's a heavy manufacturing component or import-export component. They're rated against a different set of criteria. for us, it was helpful to us not to issue our insurance policies on 500 pages of paper. So we do it electronically, and that's a way to reduce our carbon footprint. Our people travel an awful lot, so we try to reduce the travel and do more by webinar or phone. There are other standards that we look to try to perfect.
On the State of Things today, we are talking with Kevin Trapani. He is the founder and CEO of the Redwoods Group. And when we return after a short break, we'll talk about his childhood and how that entered into his ideas about corporate responsibility. We'll hear about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Kevin Trapani, founder and CEO of the Redwoods Group. The company was recently named one of the 20 best companies for the earth by B Lab, people who certify B Corps. And those are corporations with a triple bottom line. They value workers, the environment, and financial profits. You talked about traveling all over because of your dad, whose work with the VA took him from place to place. Tell us more about that. You were moving all over. You say that that's what made you more intensely community oriented. And yet, often we hear stories of just the opposite. People sort of tend to hole up. They tend to find it more difficult to make relationships because they're always on the road, and it's a different world. Why do you think it worked that way for you?
Yeah, Frank, as you all know, particularly here in the Triangle, one of the problems we have being a sort of a transitional place for a lot of folks is people are disconnected in a way. They don't have this sense of place. That was really the opposite in my experience. My mom and dad got us connected with the community immediately. And it's funny because we lived in some places as little as 9 months, in some places 2-3 years. I was blessed to be able to basically go to the same late junior high and high school, so I had a sense of home there. But it was always fascinating to me because my mom and dad held on to those friends. Even though they'd only lived in the same place for a relatively short period of time. So it was very clear to me that that sense of community was going to be important. And my mom and dad exposed me pretty early on to what was needed in those communities. We fought for things. We advocated for things. And that just became kind of a way for me.
That's interesting that you had become kind of politically involved in a place where, you know, your dad knows you're not going to stay there for a long time.
Yeah. I was born in the mid-50s, and in the early 60s, we lived in Montgomery, Alabama. And running the VA there, my dad was one of the senior federal officials in the state at a time when the federal and state relationships were not good. My dad used to get his hair cut once a week with George Wallace. And that's where information was exchanged because they were just sitting next to each other in a barber chair. And I didn't hear too much of that, or maybe I did, and I just didn't understand it. But I certainly understood that there was seismic change going on, and it affects all of us to this day.
Now, one constant for you, and you mentioned it earlier, was the why. That's always been important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
The Y is a magical organization. There are 900-some YMCAs around the United States. It's an international organization. And the great thing about the Y is that effective YMCAs are what they need to be in the community that they serve. So most people think of the Y as kind of gym and swim and camp, and it is, certainly. But the Y has gang prevention programs in deep inner city areas. They have programs for kids whose parents are in prison in places where that's important. They have programs that are unbelievably strong for diabetes prevention. The Y is an amazing, powerful social enterprise. So the Y is a not-for-profit organization, but it is financially sustainable. So that's the kind of magic at the intersection of kind of how I grew up with an organization that could accept donations and, in fact, depended on donations in a lot of ways, but also had a membership fee, also accepted government grants for certain kinds of programs, which I think is a wonderfully robust and resilient revenue structure.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that because and we'll get back to the Redwoods Group for a minute. You're an insurance company, but you're not really the insurer in this case, right? So
that's
explain
right.
How that works.
So as far as if you think about it from a customer-facing point of view, the customer comes to us. We are the ones who underwrite the risk and set the premium and the coverage terms. We provide all the risk management. We handle all the claims if something bad should happen. But we have standing behind us a pool of capital. So we work with Chartis for property and casualty risks and Hartford for workers' comp risks, and a group of reinsurers who share the risk with them. So they provide no direct services. We provide all the direct services. It is ultimately an effective collaboration. We're the experts in the narrow space that we serve. They are the ones that have the financial resources to pay the claims when the time
comes. But to pay the claims, they have to invest their money. Does Redwoods Group care how they do that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There are two levels of investment that we pay attention to. One, obviously, we have a surplus on our own. One of the things that a good social enterprise does is it builds a hedge against volatility, right? When things are good, one thing we know is eventually things will be bad, so we want to put away a reserve. And we're very careful about how we invest that money. By the way, interestingly, we have been careful about how we invest that money since the early 2000s, and our being careful helped us to avoid completely any sense of loss whatsoever in the 2008 economic meltdown. We'd been not only conservative, but mostly invested in municipal bonds and in businesses that operated from a social standpoint effectively. So we lost no money during that period of time. I probably could spend a long time bragging about that, but let it stand that we feel good about that. Yeah. We've been less successful in looking at the billions that are invested in by Chartis or Hartford, but I will tell you that during the time that the AIG, Chartis is the insurance companies of the former AIG, during the time of the AIG meltdown, we felt great that we were not a part of nor invested in any way in any of the AIG financial services organizations. We were invested in AIG, the property and casualty organization.
But again, it sort of raises this question about whether or not that's the next level. Do we have to say, if you want to be financially responsible and, you know, qualify, should we look at another standard? Where does this money go? And what's that money doing to the earth and to the people who are working for it?
You bet. I had the chance to visit with the woman who runs Patagonia's sustainability program. You know Patagonia, wonderful. Mm-hmm. She calls them an environmental company that sells clothes to fund their mission, which I just love that construct. But they've spent an awful lot of time trying to understand supply chain efficacy. So where does the cotton come from? Who is working on the sewing floor? And that's what you're describing. We're not a manufacturing business, but where is the money coming from to fund the claims, for instance? And there's an organization, you mentioned B-Lab earlier, and we've talked about the certification work that B-Lab does. Mm. B-Lab's doing great work in an area called GIRS, G-I-I-R-S, Global Investment Impact Rating System. It's kind of the Standard & Poor's or Moody's for social responsibility. And there are now thousands of companies that have been through GIRS rating, and 22 major investment funds have had their entire portfolio evaluated. And one is right here in Durham. SJF Ventures has had their portfolios, all the companies in their portfolios rated. And they then go back to those companies to say either, congratulations, you're doing a terrific job, or, hey, you know what, here's some areas we have to work on, no differently than they would say, hey, listen, here's some areas in your operating outcomes that are a problem for us. So this area of impact investment is a growing area, and it's one that we will depend on to be looking at how Chartis is investing. I call them our funds, but the funds generally of the folks they represent.
Well, let's stay with this idea for just a little bit longer and talk about what it would take. It seems to me there's this whole universe of businesses at the, you know, $100,000, $200,000 level that would take to start up. And so let's call them the Kickstarter businesses, mm-hmm. right? So there are all these people willing to give money to a very good idea, and we found a way to bring them together, Kickstarter and others like it. There doesn't seem to be a financial market, a stock exchange that would allow for investment of slow money. It might be a slower return. This is a small business, but I'm willing to lend my money at a small rate of interest. Doesn't that seem smart? And after 2008, that world got bigger because only people at the top will look at things that have very little risk, and that means startups are pretty much off the books. Yeah. Where is that world, and why hasn't somebody moved to fill that niche?
Well, that's happening. The Social Venture Network is a kind of a it is a name for an individual group of investors, lots and lots of investors, but who share exactly what you've just described in terms of resources and patience and an appreciation for a broader set of stakeholders than just themselves. There are dozens of funds that are growing in that regard. That are providing access to folks who will participate at a lower level. You described Kickstart as an example. There's a group at a bottom end of that, which is a good model too, which is Kiva, that I know you know about, which is where we make micro loans to people in, generally in Africa and other areas, to start small businesses. And the return there is that the repayment rates are higher than they are for traditional commercial loans, which is just unbelievable when you think about it. So there's an appetite for and increasingly a platform for those kinds of investments in the social venture network model.
Could we, you know, you mentioned earlier why you thought the Y was a great model as a nonprofit. It had some fees, but it also took donations. Are we living in a world that a rising media star in economics, a guy named Tomasz Sedlacek, calls zombie economics? The nonprofits are over here, they're our soul. Businesses over here, they're feeding our bodies. And we really don't ask too many questions about how that happens because we feed our soul now and then. Shouldn't we bring body and soul together? Wouldn't it make sense to have these worlds making a small profit and making small profits for investors?
You bet. That's the world of social enterprise. And in fact, Professors Porter and Kramer, in an article called Creating Shared Value in January 2011, Harvard Business Review, just now a seminal article in this constantly evolving movement, they called it Creating Shared Value. And they just said, hey, listen, we got to come to understand something. There's been a collapse in consumer appetite and capacity because we don't have the same access to debt that we used to have. And businesses are going to have to find a way to sell something. And so why not build our businesses in ways that solve significant social problems? Why not find a way to monetize the provision of clean water in sub-Saharan Africa, as an example, which is what you're describing? And it may be that the return on those investments will be smaller or slower, but probably more consistent if measured only in a financial way. But if they're measured in terms of overall impact, not just financial impact, but societal impact, the returns are spectacular. And so that's exactly what's happening. And so that's why I describe the Y or a good JCC or a good camp as a social enterprise, because their business is to lift community. Lifting community means higher educational accomplishment, better access to housing and healthcare, but less need for healthcare. It is a healthier community.
I want to get back to your biography a little bit. You went to Duke and business school there. Why did you choose Duke?
Yeah, I actually didn't go to business school. I went to Duke as an undergrad, and I had a great experience. And I picked it, quite frankly, because it was the best combination of academics and athletics. I played some sports there, and it was a tremendous place to go.
Played lacrosse?
I did.
What was your reaction when you saw that, when that story broke, as a lacrosse player, somebody who's an alum? How did you feel about that?
You know, I thought Dr. Broadhead had exactly the right comment the very weekend that it broke. He said the guy's behavior was boorish but not criminal. And that was a great way to characterize it. It was indefensible, but unfortunately not atypical. And as we now know, there was a very different agenda. The national media had a lot to say about what happened. At the end of the day, a lot of kids had a very, very difficult time. It was a bad situation. But I think, living here in Durham, as you know, I think it was the catalyzing event that frankly brought Duke closer to this community than it had been before, in a much more intentional way. Duke and NC Central are partnered on more things. Duke and Carolina are partnered on more things. Duke is more invested in downtown Durham. So I think in many ways it was a long-term healthy event for the community, although a horrible thing to have to go through.
You talked about the big insurance companies you worked for before you founded your own Redwoods Group. What got you into insurance? How did you start thinking along those lines?
When I graduated from Duke was the time when, if you were an engineer, you could pretty much write your ticket anywhere. If you were a liberal arts major, which I was, political science, you had to kind of sleep out in front of the career office the night before and hope you would get to sign up for something. And I signed up for a number of different places. And at the end of the day, I got a job offer from the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies. And I remember picking between Chubb and Procter & Gamble. Chubb offered me $12,006 a year and Procter & Gamble a little over $15,000, which seemed to me like that would be the right place to go. My dad said, hey, listen, your first year, you got to make enough money to buy a couple suits, pay your rent, and buy beer on the weekends. Take the job you really want. And I'd really been challenged by a guy at Chubb to come in and contribute immediately. I loved the way that company did business, and it was a different thing. So that's really why I chose the company.
And you've worked at, we talked about the why, and then also several Jewish community centers. You mm-hmm. mentioned those. How did you get involved with JCCs?
I was working in New Haven, Connecticut at one point, and got a few hours lifeguarding at a JCC pool as a lifeguard growing up, and was lifeguarding when a young mom came in with her autistic child. And she was really struggling. And there was nobody else in the pool at the time, so I got in and kind of helped her out. We got to know each other a little bit, and I came to understand that there was a whole community of moms and autistic children, and autistic kids often love the water, the tactile experience of the water. So I started a program at the JCC to teach autistic kids to swim, which was a great example. I had a guy who believed in me who said, well, let's go get it done. Let's figure out how to make that happen.
How did you make that happen? That's a challenging group of kids to work with. Did you have to get any training just in working with those kids?
I did, but I learned a really valuable thing. In the world of social enterprise, no one party needs to bring all the tools to the table. So the JCC had the facility, right? You kind of needed a pool. The mom had the social capital. She knew the movement of parents who had the kids who needed what they needed. I didn't know the first thing. I knew a lot about teaching kids to swim. I knew a lot about aquatic safety, but I didn't know anything about autism, which we now know is a kind of a continuum. And so Yale University was, you know, in New Haven, and there were wonderful people who understood autism really well. And they came and helped two of us to really understand how to build a curriculum around teaching those kids to swim. We had half of it, they had half of it, and we learned the third, if you will, which was how do you then make it work?
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very difficult but incredibly rewarding work.
So you came back to the Triangle then with your family.
I did.
What brought you back here?
I mentioned I got fired a few times, which a lot of people would learn after the first time, but I'm a little hard-headed. And so we came back here to start Redwoods, and really because of a few things. First of all, almost unlimited access to smart people, whether experienced PhD-level people or new college grads. This is incredibly rich, as you well know, rich area. It is an area that I continue to believe is different than many other metropolitan areas in the U.S. in that you can get things done here. A few phone calls and you can be connected to the right people. And there is an intense belief in this community in addressing problems. Not always right. We don't always get it right. But there's a clear feeling of community.
You hear that often, and I wonder where you think that comes from. What's your guess about why that's true here in the Triangle?
A couple things. One, there's a long history of addressing social problems here. You think about Terry Sanford and the North Carolina Fund and Governor Hunt and all the wonderful things that he did. And so there's a sense unique among Deep South states of serving those at the margins. And that's not new. So that's first. Second, I think the universities grow a group of people who come to understand or be focused on what's possible as opposed to what is. And then third, there are an awful lot of folks who have come here very intentionally, whether they seek better weather or whatever. They come and they want to then build a life, and they invest in that life. They invest their time and their money. And so there's this wonderful group of people who want to be connected. I'll just give you a quick example. I'm the chair of a triangle-wide CEO build for Habitat for Humanity. We're building four houses in the four counties in the core of the triangle, 60 CEOs who are committed. And a lot of us are asking folks to contribute a little money and come out and swing a hammer, which is always interesting to watch CEOs build a house. I'm sure the staff has to show up the next day and fix it. But in any event, I haven't been told no by anybody. And they want to because Habitat for Humanity is a wonderful social enterprise, mm-hmm. Because they want the connection of fellowship with other CEOs who care.
You talked about getting fired from a bunch of other companies, or at least a few, and the upshot of it was that you were thinking along different lines than they were. Certainly when you're trained for business, and because financial profit has to be the number one concern by most charters, there is this way of thinking if you want to get ahead. How would you address that? I mean, it seems to me your head was in a different place to begin with, and so you were either going to sink or swim or make your own company. But there's a whole lot of people who get trained not to think about the world around them if they want to succeed.
Yeah, I want to be really clear about two things. First of all, I got fired because I wasn't good enough then to do what I do now. And so, yeah, my ideals were the same, but I didn't understand how to make a social enterprise work. It's not easy work. When all you're trying to do is solve for profit, that's frankly relatively easy. Profit is important to Redwoods, but it's simply important as a metric of sustainability. It's not an end. And so there are folks listening to the show right now that maybe aren't CEOs of their own company, or maybe they are, or are working somewhere in a mid-level situation. What those folks need to understand is that they don't need to check their personal values at the door when they go to work. They need to begin to have a conversation about what's important. One of the things that I say all the time is you can only lead from where you stand, but you must. And so all they need to do is say, hey, listen, we can accomplish our profit goals, but we can also do these other things and find a way to solve for both.
We're going
to
take a break right here and then figure out how, because any kind of leadership comes from a certain sort of instinct which you develop and mold over time. And so how that training gets built in will be the source of our next question as our conversation with Redwoods CEO Kevin Trapani continues on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Kevin Trapani, CEO and founder of the Redwoods Group here in the Triangle. We were talking before the break about training for business and how to include a triple bottom line. I mean, are business schools teaching what you're talking about?
By and large, business schools are teaching a traditional approach to business, right? How do we account for the dollars in and dollars out and solve for a profit? The best business schools, and quite frankly, we're really fortunate here because we've got two of the best business schools within 10 miles of one another, Kenan Flagler and Fuqua, are becoming very intentional about teaching critical thinking about community connectedness. Duke's mission is knowledge and service to society. Fuqua wants to build leaders of consequence. And so in their initiatives today, they are trying to teach folks to serve community from the platform of business. The largest club at Fuqua is a group called Net Impact, which is all about what you described earlier, to measure impact both financially and societally. So I'm very encouraged with where the best business schools are going.
And you talked about it earlier, too. Michael Porter's latest work from the Harvard Business School, no less, that shows how profitability will be hurt if you do. So it's not a matter of saying, oh, guys, let's open up a little bit. Your business is going to go under if you don't start working this into the picture.
So we're here at American Tobacco, which was the vision of Jim Goodman. One of the things that Jim Goodman says is no business can succeed in a community that's failing. And that's just a fact. Maybe you can succeed for a short period of time, but eventually you don't have people who are well enough educated to do your work. You don't have people who are wealthy enough to buy your products. So the long view is pretty practical at the end of the day.
So there's a whole theory, a body of thought that says, absolutely, you're right, Kevin, let business take care of it. And in fact, what we don't need is a lot of government intervention, a lot of rules about how we should run our business. Just let us take care of it, and we'll find pretty soon all of these problems, social and financial, are going to be solved.
Yeah, there's a middle way. Businesses can and should be powerful forces for positive social change. And I think we've been talking about how that can be possible and how that's good for the business as well as being good for society. At the same time, whether government has a role as a referee or government has a more active role, I think we've seen that regulations can be important to protect civil society in many ways, but regulations can also be controverted. And so regulations on their own are not an answer. At the end of the day, it's interesting to me because the way I think we need to be training business leaders, I made some comments about this at Fuqua a few months ago. We give people an MBA, master's in business administration. I think we've got to give people a master's in moral courage, because too often we find business leaders do what they can instead of doing what they should. Now, we all know what we should do. And sometimes that's not necessarily immediately rewarded. That doesn't mean over the long term it isn't the right thing to do, both for your business and for your character. And so I think in business school and high school, we ought to be talking about values and character more than we do, because at the end of the day, we will behave in the way we are called by our belief system to behave.
But let me ask you, if you're not getting back to zombie economics, if I have a separate award for moral courage, isn't that the most improved award? Yeah, but I got the MBA, Kevin, and that's really what we're here for.
And you're right. That's why I'm saying I think when we teach business, everybody has an ethics course. I think that's the wrong way to do it. Why would you bolt on ethics? Right. To me, it's the way we do what we do. So when we look at accounting, we don't look at it as a way to kind of flout the system and get around it. We look at it as a way to enable the good work that we want to do.
Even this business of government regulation becomes a paradox. If you talk about getting money to flow into some of these smaller ventures, the little tiny capillaries that feed inner city communities, part of the problem is that if you have more than 30 investors, you fall under SEC regulation. We like the SEC. We like the fact that there are rules and regs, though it wasn't much help in 2008. So there's the paradox. For the big guys, they can go crash the system with volumes of regulations, and yet they serve as impediments in some ways to allowing capital to flow into some of these smaller capillaries.
Right. And it's interesting because there's a model that people are talking about a great deal more now, but the concept is 50 years old. Paul Ilvesacker called philanthropy society's passing gear. And what he said was, we have philanthropy in the wrong place right now. Just as you described, there's this kind of, I'll make myself feel better by writing a big check after I've gone and created huge profits in my company. Ilvesacker said, hey, listen, we should be smart philanthropists. We should invest our philanthropic money like a venture capitalist does. We had to find however many, if we believe in improving education, as an example, let's fund 30 projects in education that look like they have a good chance of succeeding. Now, we know 30 won't work, but 5 might. And when they do, if we funded them over a long enough period of time against clearer metrics, now we can go back to government and say, listen, stop spending your money the way you are. You're going to spend money anyway. Spend it in a more effective way. And that's a great role, and it turns philanthropy on its head. It's not the long-term provider. Government is the long-term provider. Philanthropy is the vetting arm. Mm. And that's a way of democratizing, if you will, the investment in those kinds of ventures.
So what would the metrics look like? Do we monetize social change, or do we take a different look at how we value those social improvements?
Well, let's look what's going on here in eastern North Carolina near Rocky Mount. There's a KIPP school, K-I-P-P, Knowledge is Power program, which is an amazing school. They went into a community where the high school graduation rate was 15%, and they've now graduated their second class from Gaston Prep. And their goal is not 100% high school graduation. It's 100% college attendance. And so they went through, they changed completely. They go to school on Saturdays. They go to school until 5 o'clock every day. They demand a certain level of parental involvement. And I know that's not the right answer for everybody, but it's the right answer for more people who have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. Once they go through 4 or 5 classes like that, they'll be able to go back to the county and the state and say, hey, listen, we can get significantly higher graduation and college attendance rates through this kind of curriculum. And so let's begin to fund that kind of education as opposed to the traditional education that's been.
Yeah, but you have to take one step back, don't you? You have to say, why do I care if graduation rates go up? You think you do, but how am I going to value that? Is it a monetary value, or is it something about the improvement of each of us?
Well, of course, it's a stair step, right? Because on the first level, you say, yeah, we'd rather kids graduate from high school than not, because we know what it costs us in terms of social assistance or incarceration or healthcare problems or whatever. So you can demonstrate very, very clearly that a high school graduate costs our society less. I'm simply arguing from a financial standpoint. The second level of it is what do they then produce in terms of economic output as opposed to what they cost? What do they produce? Then you extend that to if they have a college experience, what do they produce and how much less do they cost? All these are trackable and clear metrics that we can accomplish. Now, they need a little longer ramp. Mm-hmm. In Finland, when they looked at that, the first thing they decided to do was to take it out of the political governmental realm. They chartered a completely different educational organization that the 4-year terms couldn't fund or defund. And they've improved educational outcomes in incredible ways. I think you now know Finland basically leads the civilized world in terms of educational outcomes. And now they're beginning to lead the civilized world in terms of innovation and technology.
And that's what they did. So the accountability mechanism was to set up a structure that had to operate by those rules. We don't. I mean, if you heard This American Life, the wonderful Colorado Springs example, don't tax me. It would cost me $200 for you to turn on the lights. I'll pay $300 to turn on the lights as long as government doesn't do it. So there are the books, there are the ledgers. You're paying more. And that's the choice you make, of course. But again, whether or not you're forced to operate under a system of fiduciary responsibility, lower cost is better for everybody, so government wins. So how do you make it a measure of accountability or the system, the standard by which we all have to live?
Well, I have to take a step back because what it requires is a civil discourse about the important things that face our society. And I actually am pretty hopeful. I think it will be very hard for us to get much worse on that score than we are today. Today we stand on both sides of the aisle and we throw rocks at each other, and whether you're red or blue, you're not without sin. But I think we're getting people to step forward and say, I won't take that anymore. You look at the congressional approval ratings and those kinds of things, even on a state legislature basis. People are not happy with what their representatives are doing. I think we're approaching a presidential election where it's going to come to a head, that us just yelling at each other and demonizing the other side isn't going to get us anyplace. So I think we will begin having civil discourse. There will be people at both ends of the spectrum who don't want to talk about this kind of stuff. But more of us are in the middle looking for solutions. And I think we'll get to the place where we can look more long term at what is appropriate governmental social investment. How do we create a society that's healthier for all?
Are there rule changes that are necessary before that happens at the federal level or at the state level?
Well, yes, but I don't think they have to happen before we can begin having better conversations. At the moment, what's happening, you asked at the beginning of the show about B-Lab. There's nothing regulatory that started B-Lab. Some of the best work that's being done in education and healthcare is work that's being done by folks who are reacting to market opportunities, folks who are reacting to moral opportunities, not necessarily, you know, government enabled. So I think these things can happen in parallel. One thing that could happen here in North Carolina that's happened now in seven states, including New York and New Jersey and California, big states, is B legislation. So the recognition of a company like Redwoods as a for-benefit corporation. At the moment, fortunately, we are all privately held or all owned by employees. But if we are owned by any outside investors, when we give money away, the investors could take action against me as the CEO for doing something that didn't benefit the business. And that's one thing that this legislation will change.
I was going to say, that's if you look at the way most big corporations are chartered, when the financial return is the number one priority. So as you suggested, you have to be careful with shareholders' money or you're out of a job and you can be sued. So then when they go to lobby, clearly they're going to lobby for the interest of financial return. That's the rule. That's the way they were chartered. Would that have to be changed in order for them to lobby differently? We've heard CEOs say over and over again, I wish I could. I'm only working quarter to quarter, and I know long term the decision I just made is going to hurt us, but I have to worry about shareholder return for this quarter.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, Frank, because I honestly believe that that's a culture of victimization. It's interesting to me to look at Costco versus Walmart. So the guy, you listen in or take a look at any Costco annual meeting, and always there are people that stand up and say, why do you pay your people so much? Why do you pay so much in health benefits? And the answer, shorthand, is if you really want to take your money and invest someplace else, go do it. They have been very clear that they're not going to be overly focused on quarter over quarter returns, that they're going to pay their people a living wage, and that's how they're going to run their business. And they're still selling stock. Now, are they taking a haircut on the value of the stock? If they are, it's a part of their financial equation. I said before, you can only lead from where you stand, but you must. And there's no reason for any CEO anywhere to behave in any way that's different than their personal values. If they are behaving in a different way, then their values are different. So I think you can stand up and behave in the way that your values call you to behave. And I think it's happening more and more often today than ever before.
Well, the other strange disconnect, and you use the Costco-Walmart example, Costco is more profitable. They actually make more money at the end because of the everyday low prices and everything else that happens at Walmart, maybe 13 and Costco. So their annual operating profit is higher. It's just the share value, which is Las Vegas. That money doesn't go back to Costco. That gets traded by traders.
That's right. And because Walmart's model is a growth model, they need the share value to be as high as possible so that they can build more stores. So Costco is constrained a little bit in terms of their moving to scale, but they are, as you say, they are more operating profitable. And I think that's a beautiful model.
What's the future for Redwoods?
We have a wonderful upside. We have room to serve more of the customers in our chosen customer groups. More importantly, we still have not eradicated child sexual abuse. We still have not stopped kids from drowning, although I think we've done very good work in that area and are proud of that work. But until we stop kids from being abused, our work will remain. And I'll give you a quick example of that. We are partnered with a group of YMCA leaders and a group called Darkness to Light, a nonprofit from Charleston, South Carolina. And we are locked in a battle that in 10 years we think will eradicate child sexual abuse. We're going to train 12 million U.S. adult residents to understand, recognize, and respond to the warning signs of child sexual abuse. As they said in Moneyball, if we get this done, we'll change the game. And I think that's what we're about to do.
Is that where you think it is in training volunteers or training workers to recognize signs?
I do believe that. This is not the child's problem. The predator manipulates the child to be responsive to his or her sexual advances. This is an adult problem. Every time we see an adult child sexual abuse situation, other people come forward and say, you know, there was something unusual about that relationship. And they weren't ignoring it on purpose. They just didn't recognize it, the gift giving, the time alone. They didn't recognize it for what it was. When the Sandusky or Bernie Fine stories come out, we can tell you what happened before the story comes out because the pattern, the model is the same every time. And I'm very bullish on how this training is working already. Thousands of people have been trained, and we're beginning to be able to see that attitudes are different, and attitudes precede behaviors, and behaviors precede changing outcomes.
And looking at the overall environment, I'm not talking about abuse in particular, but you just in terms of business, where we're headed, you know, this growing divide that we're seeing within our economy and society. You have three young children. Are you optimistic about their futures?
Oh, I really
in this world.
I really am. I have a 26-year-old daughter, actually, who's a teacher in the Bronx and just about to get her MBA or master's in teaching from Columbia. She's an inspiration to me. Her generation just lives to serve, lives to have the work that has meaning. I have 10-year-old twins who have unlimited possibility, partially because we haven't taught them to give up their ideals. You know, we want things to be the way they want them to be. So I feel very hopeful, Frank, but I also am not naive. I know where we are. You know, one in six in this country lives in poverty, and the poverty threshold, $22,000, is woefully inadequate. You raise that to $35,000, it approaches one in three. So we have people who are really, really hurting, but we're talking about it. You know, people laugh at Occupy Wall Street, but I think they won, because we have a presidential candidate whose record of business success is a liability for him. We are talking about the people at the margin in this society in a way that we didn't before. And I think that's what was necessary to get us to the place where we begin to affect real solutions.
Kevin, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being in the program.
Thank you for having me here, Frank.
Kevin Trapani, co-founder of and CEO of the Redwoods Group. For more information about the company, including the recent recognition by B-Lab for being good for the earth, go to redwoodsgroup.com. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.